Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman, and I am solo, except not really, this week because Aaron and Radha are both on road trips crisscrossing the country from California to probably somewhere in Utah by now. And I think Aaron may actually be on her way back to DC at this point in time, but they couldn't join us. So I decided to have a Bombshell takeover this week with a whole bunch of different guests. We have, I'll just mention their names briefly, and then we'll introduce everybody later on. Ashley Fang from the Center for New American Security. She is a research associate in the Economic and Energy Security Program at CNAS. Kaylee Thomas, who is a research associate in the Middle East Security Program. Megan McGee, who is a former CNAS intern, recent graduate of Georgetown Security Studies. Hijab Shah, who is an associate fellow in the International Security Program at CSIS. And last but not least, Kara Frederick, who is a fellow with the technology program at Center for New American Security. So obviously, this is going to be a different kind of show. We're not going to go through our normal format. I am instead going to interview each of these amazing experts on a topic that of their choosing, one that they bring pretty unique perspective and viewpoints on, but also one that I think in each of their cases, or for the most of their cases, has an interesting generational shift going on right now, whether it be a literal generational shift or a big kind of change in perspective and viewpoints on a matter of security policy that the United States has been confronting for a while. But before we get started on that, I will say that I am drinking as usual, a Casal Garcia Vino Verde, because it's like 4% alcohol by volume and more or less like drinking juice, sort of lightly carbonated juice. Does anyone else have anything exciting drinking going on?
Oh, I am drinking mint lemonade kombucha. So non-alcoholic sparkling juice, basically.
That sounds disgusting. I'm not going to lie. Kombucha is just wrong. It's wrong and it's wrong. I'm sorry, Kaylee. Like, I'm going to let you stay on, but it's wrong.
Thank you. All right. All right. Understood.
I am drinking something fairly similar to what Kaylee is drinking. I'm repping Team Halal and not drinking kombucha, but it is a sparkling probiotic drink, but it's also a lime mint coconut drink. So it's delicious, and I do concur. I think I've had kombucha accidentally once. It tasted gross, and then I found out it has alcohol, so can't drink it anyway. I'm not losing anything over here.
And I just finished up a kiwi fruit tea. If you're in DC and you want bubble tea, go to Share Tea.
I feel like this must be a younger than 40 thing where people decided that liquids and beverages of some kind can be both healthy, non-alcoholic, and do something funky in some way. Like, we just basically drank Kool-Aid as I was growing up, and now it's like, no, it has like 39 flavors, is organic, and had young maidens from Norway pluck the berries from the bush and crush them with their heels. Like, that's great. I'm just gonna have some wine now. Okay, we are going to start, as usual, with the Bombshell questions. Because we have so many guests, we are not going to have everybody engage on all of them, but pick one of choice. So I will start, and ladies, just speak up whenever your favorite has come up. So the first Bombshell question is, what skill or talent do you wish that you had?
I wish I was a songwriter because I obsess over lyrics and songs. And I sometimes dabble in some poetry that no one will ever see.
Meg, you need to have people see this. One of the first dates I ever went on in DC was to a poetry slam. And I won't tell you which one, but it was with one of the founders of Vox. I know. And isn't that amazing? Just like the mental image of that right there. The whole date was just horrible. But I do admire anybody who can stand up and like recite poetry and their own songs in front of everybody. So, all right, you know, fingers crossed for you someday. Anyone else on the first question?
Okay, so my talent that I would love to have, it's one of those things where it's completely useless, but I want it to be able to have it just so I can say that I have it. And that's the ability to memorize really long strings of numbers. You know, the people who like will go into on Pi Day, they'll like walk into the office or your class and they'll be like, oh, Pi is 3.14, blah, blah, and like rattle it off. I have always wanted to be able to do that, even though it's almost completely useless.
I mean, Kara, I feel like in the tech program, that just sort of like a weird sort of cred that people throw out every once in a while. It's like, oh, yeah, well, I memorized Pi, but losers do Pi. I did this other random infinite number that other people do. So I admired the impulse. I think I tried when I was in like seventh grade.
Well, the thing is, do you remember that episode of Alias where two spies were going head-to-head and Jennifer Garner was one of them, and she memorized this one number in, like, a cave for, I don't know, the other one was going to die or something like that, and she got it first, and they were like, oh, and they, like, ran away, and she recited the number, and I was like, man, that girl, oh, yeah, that's the dream.
Those are skills right there. Yeah, like, they don't tell you about that when you're being recruited for spy school. They're like, can you memorize long numbers? It just comes in handy later. You just don't know. All right, next question. What book do you wish you could live inside forever? Ashley.
So I have two. So putting aside the entire, like, Harry Potter universe. So the first one is a Tamora Pierce universe. It's not Tortell. It is the Circle series. That's my first one. My second one is V.E. Schwab. She has another, like, YA fantasy trilogy called A Darker Shade of Magic, and I would also love to live there. Just, like, the fact that, like, there's magic that exists in the world that isn't, like, explained by science. And also in like, the Stargo series, like, and also Tamora Pierce's, like, you know, entire, like, feminist bent, and, like, having really strong and empowering female characters. Like, I would love to live in that world.
I may have invited at least two of the people on the show this week because they are huge Tamora Pierce fans. And both of you need to read the Elementals trilogy by Sherry Thomas. Very, very similar pro-feminist vibes. Also has, like, British boarding school magic, sort of, like, forbidden romance, other elements to it. It's great. Super good.
I'm writing that down.
So did I.
Okay. Who else has a book they want to live inside for forever?
So mine, I mean, again, putting aside the Harry Potter stuff, it would be great to live in a Harry Potter world where we respect trans rights. But apart from that, on the topic of other problematic British female authors, I grew up, again, repping the Commonwealth. I grew up reading Enid Blyton, who is a British author kind of from the interwar years. And she wrote some really awesome kids' books. Which have been, you know, since, like, kind of censored, or not quite censored, but there are some problematic elements have been changed in it. But there's a series that I read as a child called the Faraway Tree series, which features this family of kids that live out in the countryside. They find this enchanted forest that has a tree called the Faraway Tree, massive tree, kind of Jack and the Beanstalk-esque, ends up every week in a new world. So that would be pretty cool to have the ability to go and travel into a new world every week. So that would be my pick.
All right, last one. What robot do you wish you had in your house? Haley.
I wish that I had a dog grooming robot.
Oh, man, yeah.
Had the fortune and the luck to rescue a dog that both sheds insane amounts of white fur, but also... like, has the longest, like, tail and butt hair known to man that just, like, need to be trimmed. So, for hygienic purposes. So I really wish I could just shut him in the bathroom with a robot and he would come out, like, sparkling clean and happy. And I wouldn't have to look at his, like, sad puppy dog eyes that think I am, like, somehow doing him the greatest wrong ever in the world.
That's amazing. Meg, did you answer one? I can't remember. Did you have a robot?
For robot, definitely my laundry, because I'm very, very particular about how I wash everything. And I sort it perfectly. There's certain things that have to be hang dried. Other things can go in the machine, but only for like 20 minutes. It's a bit much.
I right now would take a robot that just went around and told my son how to get to the next level in the whatever Lego mini game that he's in. It's like pretty constant. He'll be on a Zoom, comes like, mama, how does he go? What do you do to get to this level? I'm like, I don't know. Do you see that I'm on a Zoom? He doesn't care. So that would be very helpful if people could help out on that. Or he particularly really wants to play Mario Brothers and we won't let him because we know it would just be constant. Okay, so moving on to the exciting substantive part of our show, we're going to start with Ashley. Ashley is leaving Sandia soon to head off to grad school, which is sad for all of us, but good for the universe because she will be doing more work on China, U.S.-China relations, China economic issues, and other things that we'll be talking about today. So, Ashley, what is so important about the U.S.-China economic relationship that you wanted to talk about today at our bombshell episode?
Sure. And also, I would just like to say, huge fan of this podcast. When I was in Europe, I literally met somebody who was like, "You work at CNES. Do you know Lauren? Do you know Bombshell?" So you have fans globally. So on the U.S.-China economic competition, like, why is it so important? So I think there are a couple of different factors here. So the first one is we have, like, China is now, you know, the world's second largest economy. It's becoming a lot more aggressive, and a lot of people view it as the potential challenger to replacing the United States in this global geopolitical system. And the second part is you're seeing economic statecraft become a lot more center to the U.S.-China relationship as a whole. And you're seeing both countries use what we at CNES had done research on called China, you know, economic statecraft, and deploying coercive economic tools against each other. So I guess, like, the definition that we go with when it comes to coercive economic measures is things like export restrictions, import restrictions, sanctions, those types of things. So basically tools that both countries can use to achieve their own national security and foreign policy goals. And so as China has become a bigger competitor within this larger geopolitical and geoeconomic system, the United States is becoming a little bit nervous because there's now actually a challenger that can challenge U.S. dominance over, you know, like things like the global financial system and challenge U.S. foreign policy in a way that we just haven't seen in a really long time. So recently, as China is becoming more aggressive and expanding its definition of what its core national interests are, you're seeing it violate international norms. So for example, like take Hong Kong. So in 1997, when the United Kingdom and China signed its agreement to hand over Hong Kong back to China, they said that they would have until 2047. And during this time, China would respect international law, treat Hong Kong as, like, you know, as its own independent territory. But recently, you're seeing this confluence in which both Hong Kong and other territories that, you know, like the youth and also people who live in these territories that are controlled by China, they want more self-determination and they want more independence. And China is going ahead and violating international norms by clamping down on these protests. So the United States, what have they done? They have, after China recently introduced its national security law and started implementing it, it essentially clamped down on all of these, like, international human rights and things that they promised the international system that they would respect until 2047. So the United States responded by saying that they would revoke a Hong Kong special status. They said, and a couple other economic statecraft things. That's one aspect in this larger competition. So China has also interned over 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. And recently, the United States, for the first time, decided to place CCP officials under the Global Magnitsky sanctions on the SDN list. So this is, again, like a new red line that you're seeing the United States cross when it comes to China. And China, for its part, is also trying to expand its own international economic and financial power as well. So with a couple of different laws, including the national security law, you're not just seeing China clamp down domestically, you're also seeing them trying to extraterritorialize some of its economic powers as well. So a great example of this is its recent second draft of its export control law, in which it talks about how it wants to externalize and basically create an export control system in which anybody who doesn't respect China's core national interests underneath this export control system, domestically, they are now subject to Chinese penalization. So I'll just stop there.
You teed up two big questions I want to dig into a little bit. And the first is, I mean, you could, if I wanted to play devil's advocate a bit, and then that's always the more fun thing to do in the show, is, and you could go through U.S. economic statecraft and its reliance on sanctions, it's how it has become a major political power due to a lot of its economic influence worldwide, and the overall power of its export and import market, how it dominates the financial system through the dollar economy and so on. Well, how is what is China doing different? And I'm guessing that there are different aspects to it, but can you talk about how, when China exercises its economic power, what are some of the instances whereby what it's doing is different than how the United States does it?
Yeah. So I think, like, a really great example here would be, like, Huawei, right? Which, like, we've heard about multiple times at this point. So for example, Meng Wanzhong, who's the CFO of Huawei, she violated U.S. sanctions, right? And there was a deliberate attempt to do so, and there was evidence that was provided. So Canada decided to arrest Meng Wanzhong, and then like they're going through the entire extradition case now. And in retaliation, China isn't just retaliating within domain economically, right? China is taking other steps. For example, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, who are two Canadian citizens, China decided to retaliate against a U.S. ally, not directly against the United States, which initiated this action. That's the first thing. And the second thing is China is using its own domestic extrajudicial system in order to retaliate for something that is a foreign policy-related issue. And so you're seeing this extrajudicial exercise by China and basically using all tools at their power out of domain. And I think a lot of people would also argue like out of proportion as well. So Meng Wanzhong, like, she's in Canada, she is under house arrest, but she has an ankle bracelet and she's still free to go everywhere. Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig have been locked in China. They have not been able to gain access to lawyers, and they basically were under extrajudicial detention for over a year before they were formally charged. So there's still some sort, I think you could say, like rule of law and a specific sort of process in which like the United States and Canada and other international actors are respecting that China is not.
Ashley, the other thing I wanted to dig into is that the probably Bush-Obama era China policy would have approached or may have possibly approached the issue of the Uyghurs detention and other some of the economic moves that China's pursuing differently, or at least you could make a guess that they might have done so a little bit differently. I mean, not that the Trump administration has necessarily covered itself in glory in how it's responded, in particular to the Uyghur detention issue, but my sense is that there was both the hope that China's economic opening would lead to greater liberalization of its politics, which we haven't seen to be the case. But there's still people who believe that that is the case and we should just sort of leave them alone domestically. And that likewise, the United States should not be intervening in the domestic sphere of other people's countries unless they really wanted to put a lot of muscle behind it in some way. So how are you seeing within the China policy community of the United States, what are the variations in views on this, and how are people who kind of grew up in the old US-China policy struggling with how to address some of these new challenges in the US-China relationship?
Yeah. I think a lot of people like to go with the generational divide where they say, you know, like the younger crowd of China watchers are just a lot more hawkish and a lot more confrontational and not really pro-engagement. I think that's an oversimplification. So China from the 50s up until early 2000s, unless you were reading like internal party documents, like they seemed as though like they wanted to actually integrate into the international order. So, you know, like there were judgments that were made that said that, you know, like China, as it continues growing, maybe we can shape its behavior. But, you know, they were also like people who say like, who read those internal party documents and say like, hey, you know, like Chinese leadership, CCP leadership, they're not interested in changing, right? Like they want to reap the benefits of the international system, but they don't want to play by the rules. And you're seeing an increasingly aggressive China in which, you know, as they have grown bigger economically, as they have increased their military might, they are becoming more aggressive. So, you know, people are growing up during viewing and experiencing different Chinas, which obviously will then in turn affect how you think about China as a whole, and then in turn affect the policy recommendations that you would make in order to actually handle China itself. But I still, like, there are still divides, you know, like there, like business community, there are people who still think, you know, China is a huge and emerging market, like we need to engage there, even like people my age and like, you know, and then there are people who were older who, you know, like James Mann, like he literally wrote a book about how China is aggressive, how, you know, like there are different actors within China that like are pushing not to integrate within the international system in which China wants, again, to reap the benefits, but not follow by the rules.
Kara, how is China using its information and technology power to bolster and back up its economic and political fights overseas right now?
Yeah, so this is one of the points where China has a lot of leverage, and a lot of what they're doing is, you know, not just wrapped up in the technology itself, but in the laws and the policies that are governing the use of technology. So I think that's something where, you know, you can talk about the tech itself, you can talk about how values and principles are embedded within technology, and they lead to kind of reflecting a freer world or a more closed world. But I do think it's important to sort of, as Ashley discussed, talk about something, things that are a little more nebulous, these policies, and then this ecosystem that technology exists within that includes people too. You know, the Chinese party state is going to have leverage over individuals that could be, you know, outside or inside the United States with potential access to all of this data. And that should be considered, you know, sort of the weight that they could place on individual human beings who have access to technology. So there's a lot of considerations, but in terms of sort of jumping into TikTok, if we want to go there, Lauren.
Yeah, go ahead.
No. There's something for everyone when it comes to this kind of thing and technology that's emanating from China. You have, you know, India banning almost 60 apps after the China border dispute, of which TikTok is one. You have Trump rallies wrapped up in this, the long reach of the Hong Kong national security law and how it could potentially apply to Chinese technology within that area. And then, you know, TikTok teams melting down and looking for new jobs because there might be a ban on TikTok. And that comes directly from how you open this, how China is sort of using its power behind. It's a lot of sophisticated technology that they're developing and exporting to the rest of the world. And in this case, not just surveillance technology that's more cut and dry, like facial recognition systems or anything like that, but in the form of this cute little app that Gen Z lives on, you know, 50-second videos where people are doing dances and Addison Rae is like gyrating her body and six-year-olds are kind of learning how to do things. So, you know, 60% of active users on it are between the ages of 16 and 24. So why is this harmful? People are kind of at this point scratching their heads like, you guys in the national security community, you must be bored. Like, why are you targeting this, you know, benign app that gives people joy in these, you know, times of woe and oppression? And to that, I would say that when Pompeo and then Trump the next day sort of floated that potential ban on TikTok, a lot of, you know, policymakers and even cybersecurity experts who tend to be a little more circumspect and, you know, well, now we should pull back and think about this because there is no, you know, sort of real-time data pipeline to the CCP, which matters. You know, we don't want to mischaracterize this, or we don't want to say that what China's doing is more sophisticated than it really is. And I admire the work of a lot of those scholars, but I think there are a couple considerations that we should have at the forefront of our minds when we think of potentially innocuous apps that come from China. And, you know, that's the fact of the laws that we talked about earlier. A series of laws was passed in China ages ago till now, the Cybersecurity and National Intelligence Law from 2017, that are broadly written and can ultimately compel private Chinese companies to comply with their government's request for data. So you have things like Huawei, you know, we touch on the Huawei debate a lot too when we're talking about Chinese built technology. It's sort of Huawei saying, nope, like if the government, if the party state says we want your data, there's no way we're going to give you the information. Yet they exist under laws that basically say, no, you kind of have to. And that's where things like the Hong Kong national security law comes in, right? You have to, if you work for, you know, whatever the Chinese party state is saying they want from you, then you're pretty much going to have to give it to them by law. So, you know, they're broadly written, they're open to interpretation. That's part of the point. And we see those laws kind of creeping outside of the borders of China at this point. So that's one method. And then what I talked about before, you know, this whole TikTok itself is part of a digital ecosystem of technology, actors, and markets. So if the party state has leverage over individuals with access to technology or the data the technology is collecting, then that should be of concern as well. You're not just talking about the tech itself. You're talking about laws. You're talking about people. And then third, you know, TikTok potentially provides the party state with personally identifiable information of young Americans. You know, it has access to your microphone, your contact list, your camera, your location access, your IP addresses. You know, they're sort of helping narrow a gap between China's own databases and the data from the rest of the world. And really, you know, they're playing the long game. These kids, they're going to grow up eventually. Many are going to, you know, come into the national security apparatus. And do we want China to be able to have a fulsome map of the American populace? You know, either way, even if there's not a direct national security threat today, then I think, you know, tomorrow with that long game being played, you are not looking at necessary salutary things for the United States when it comes to near peer competition with China.
So Kara, one question that does not have just one answer, there's probably many ways you could get at this, but I mean, you've mentioned the different ways that TikTok is viewed, whether by the national security community here saying like, this is the worst thing since the nuclear weapon versus the teens, teens and sometimes their grandparents who are, you know, either adorably dancing or sending messages or things or like discussing politics on TikTok in interesting ways. If we could go back a couple of years, I'm not sure what the time period is, maybe 5 years, to have better conversations both with folks in middle school, high school, and also maybe better conversations with folks in Congress about like, hey, by the way, this app's coming. Here's how we should start thinking about it and preparing for it. What do you think that those sorts of conversations might look like? I mean, is there things that we could have done better in order to both prepare for these sorts of apps, but also have a policy, be ready for a policy discussion around it?
Yeah. So what's really interesting there is sort of you highlighted the social sector, right? The American people themselves and then Congress. But I think there's sort of a missing piece here that I can tell from personal experience. You know, when I started working for Facebook in 2016, we had an allergy to anything geopolitical. We didn't necessarily have what I call a geopolitical cognition. We wanted to create things. We wanted to ship them. We wanted to iterate on them before that. And make sure they were valuable and they were, you know, useful for society. But there wasn't necessarily that national security imperative that sort of existed when you're creating these products or when you're deciding on policy to create these products, even within these organizations. So I think by talking to the private sector, by discussing with private companies, how you sort of embed, you know, that privacy by design concept into all of these applications you're creating. I think that is a critical component that if we could go back a couple of years, that's what I would do. I wouldn't just say, you know, social sector awareness is huge, letting Addison Rae know and letting her followers know and the D'Amico girls and their followers know that, you know, hey, maybe you guys should have some sort of idea that this is what could happen to your data. That's important to Congress. Yeah, this is coming down the pipe. But at the same time, it's those private sector companies, they have a stake in U.S. national security as well. And letting them know that, I think they are definitely getting the picture now, for sure. But letting the private sector know that they are national security actors as well, that programmer, you know, sitting in that closet jamming away for 16 hours a day, if he had some idea what, you know, their creations could potentially bring to bear, then I think we would be in a better place right now. And we wouldn't have to sort of retrofit a lot of these things with that privacy by design concept that we need to get into the system more and more so today.
When I worked at CNES, folks on this call will remember, I shared my bizarre obsession with the TikTok Blinded Lights Dance Challenge, as well as I think I shared with you guys the my obsession with some of the Doja Cat dances. And so one person asked, totally like having no idea what TikTok was, what is TikTok? And I was about to explain like, oh, it's this fun app that I don't actually use. I just watch it on YouTube. And one of our colleagues says like, no, it's just where the Chinese Communist Party memorizes all of your facial expressions and unique dance moves by analyzing all of your activity there. So like, not that inaccurate, but it did put a bit of a damper.
I mean, yeah. Right. When they're taking 360 degree captures of Uyghurs' gates, then it's pretty easy to sort of connect the dots there. I mean, everybody, teenagers, open your eyes. Come on.
So, Megan, I want to start shifting over to you. The U.S.-China relationship and particularly, well, I guess not just U.S.-China relationship, the relationships with China and relationship with China on technology in particular are I would say, pretty significant point of friction between the United States and Europe, though I think there's been a lot of evolutions on that over the past couple of years. But it's one of those things that we are coming to it with pretty different assumptions, but also from pretty different positions of power. And it underwrites a lot of the separate tension that we see between the United States and NATO, United States and EU, because we're both trying to figure out, you know, what does this new world look like in terms of who are the greatest threats? What is the new, what are the new institutions that we need for this? And how should we be orienting our security institutions toward them? So, you know, that you just wrote a piece in Foreign Policy, I think, talking about how Europe needs to start pushing back against the Trump administration in a variety of ways. And I've got a bunch of questions on it. But before I get to them, can you just kind of talk through, like, what were some of your key arguments there? Why did you write this piece?
Sure. It's funny because I wrote this piece in the midst of all the protests that were happening across the country in June. So in a way, it's my own form of protest. I think, you know, with the between the announcement about pulling out of Open Skies and also, you know, the swirl of rumors around what's the troop deployment going to look like in Germany, I was just surprised that there wasn't a lot of reaction on the European side, at least from the top people. And I realized that Europeans there, and I don't mean to generalize all Europeans, but I think in general,
hashtag Europe, not all Europeans. Yes.
Yes, right. Exactly. I think in general, they don't really know what to do with the Trump administration. And I think everyone's kind of holding their breath, hoping that November will bring the winds of change. And I'm basically arguing that Europe needs to leverage some of the domestic issues that are happening in the United States in order to put more pressure on Trump. So Trump making moves like drawing down troops in Germany, some people see that as him playing to the base. Look, we're reducing our footprint in Europe because Germany doesn't pay enough in defense spending. So we're going to punish them for this. Then Europe should use the overall domestic support that people have for NATO, as well as congressional members, in order to put that pressure back on the White House to take a step away. And I think even recently, in the National Defense Authorization Act for the next fiscal year, they worked in that language to secure the troop deployment numbers in Germany. So there is something to sort of backstop the Trump administration if they were to get another term from just completely removing troops if necessary. And I think a lot of people don't understand why we're still in Germany. And I think it's really important to highlight how, you know, from air bases to military hospitals, there's so much that the Germans provide for our security and, of course, the overall security of Europe. But Europe, in turn, also needs to remember that they need it as well, and that they can't just sort of hope for the best and, you know, keep their fingers crossed.
You know, after I read your piece, I was just struck by the memories of how, like, the initial reactions by European leaders to President Trump, which were very attempting to basically kind of suck up to him, to schmooze him and things like that, be very engaging. I'm thinking in particularly of France, but not only France. And then it moved into, after, you know, some of the G20, the NATO summits, G8, G7, and then G8. Like more of a sneering sort of looking down on you thing, which got them nowhere. It basically just like they assumed that President Trump and his administration was a problem to put on hold. But I mean, he has proven to be able to quickly and actively make decisions that impact their interests on a variety of fronts, your economic being key among them, but not just that, security as well. So I guess I think you're entirely right that they need to get better at pushing back on this and not assuming that the Trump administration is an aberration by any means, but that that they have political tools in order to deal with it. I just wonder if Europe is in a position to do so itself, given that I don't know. I think if you, like Germany in particular, may be a good way, may be very capable of doing it individually. But Europe itself is obviously just, they're not all friends, I think is a nice way to say it.
Nope.
but I'm curious, like, did you get any reactions from people saying like, yes, right on, we need to be pushing back? Or was it more like, oh, I give up, I don't know, what do we do?
Surprisingly, I haven't heard too much from my European counterparts.
Yeah.
And I think they're all on vacation and hopefully
oh,
not
yeah, that's a great point.
Checking Twitter. And when they do, maybe they'll have something to say. But I think overall, for instance, last summer, I was able to spend a lot of time in Berlin and talk to, you know, the think tankers, sort of the blob of Berlin. And the feeling that I got was that people did want to do more in terms of their security, at least within Germany. I can't speak for the rest of Europe, but in Germany in particular, there was a need. There was a need to want to move past the past in some ways, and that they had come to a breaking point where to continue to restrain themselves wouldn't necessarily be advantageous for overall European security, and also to be able to have their own autonomy from the United States as well. So I think we can see that even the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin, they did an excellent research about how younger generations in Germany are starting to come around and warm up to the idea that there is a way to be engaged on the global stage without necessarily it being militarily, but also using a lot of the diplomatic leverage that they do have. So I found that really interesting. I'm very curious, and maybe I'll have to start asking around this week to see what people think.
It's always dangerous and a bit scary once you put your words out there. But I think I would be very curious about the reaction, because there's so much about the Europe and U.S. security relationship that is psychological and cultural as much as it is security related, and it has so much history. I mean, like, I can make all of my romantic comedy comparisons as usual, but you have to talk yourself into things so often that are, you know, beyond just like the policies you have written on paper. Speaking of complex relationships that I have made romantic comedy allusions to, and this could be either Kaylee or Hijab. You must be wondering, who am I going to next? But no, I wanted to talk about the work that Hijab has done with Melissa Dalton, our good friend, on the U.S. working with partners overseas in hybrid warfare and in broader security systems, security cooperation capacities. They had a paper that came out, it was about a month and a half ago, called Partners Not Proxies. And they are speaking some harsh but very much needed truths on how the United States should be working with, considering, and treating its partners as we shift from a kind of global war on terror focused security strategy to one that is as much that as it is, you know, great power competition and other issues. So if you could first just kind of talk through some of the main takeaways of the paper, which was great and people should read it, and then we can get into a couple questions.
Sure thing. Yeah, so the paper we went through, I mean, we spoke with a lot of folks kind of within the U.S. allied and partner nexus to just understand a little bit about, you know, what their thoughts were around, you know, the kind of dealing with issues around hybrid warfare and gray zone warfare. I know these are controversial terms for some people, but
they define them, so it's okay.
That's right. Yeah. So we basically define them as, you know, either conflict or competition in that space between what would be considered routine statecraft and all out war. So in terms of working with allies and partners, you know, it is very tempting to cast partners as proxies in that situation, right? So if the United States is working with certain partners that are either targets of or more susceptible to, you know, coercive tools by adversaries such as China and Russia, Iran, et cetera, it's almost a temptation to kind of revert to some old tactics from the days gone by that, you know, where it was easy for the United States to kind of leverage its partners more in terms of its own proxies rather than work with them, that whole concept of by, with, and through. So we kind of look at that in particular. And, you know, it's obviously very tough. I mean, a lot of times these partners are at the front lines. They're the ones that are kind of the biggest targets of activities, you know, ranging from disinformation to cyber attacks to, you know, proxy warfare even up front. So we go through a little bit of, you know, how is it that we can work with U.S. partners and kind of make more resilient networks and more kind of, you know, less vulnerable partnerships that can deal with these sort of tactics. So we discuss in our paper, you know, the importance of a principled approach. It's too easy to kind of mirror what countries like Russia and China might be doing by kind of subverting some of those norms around, you know, everything from international humanitarian law to professionalism to civil military relations. But it's so important for the United States to use its principles as leverage and as a strong point in its partnerships to try to strengthen the resilience of its partners while working through kind of hybrid warfare or working in hybrid warfare environments. Oftentimes, the adversary is seeking to undermine the legitimacy of U.S. partners, trying to leverage sort of the predatory, corrupt tendencies that may exist in kind of less democratic partners. And so it's important to really focus on those areas. And then one personal kind of point that I feel very strongly about, and that was repeated in the interviews that I had conducted and that Melissa had conducted, was this idea of, you know, information as a tool of leverage, and how once upon a time the U.S. was really good at this. You know, so in the Cold War era, this is something that the United States was really good at dealing with. And, you know, not only as a form of kind of defending against information operations, but also deploying information operation tactics against other adversaries. And now, you know, both friends and foes have surpassed the United States in that area. And so it's both understanding where can the United States improve its own capacity in order to help out partners and allies, but also leveraging where partners actually have, you know, they have an advantage over the United States in those areas, and just really empowering them and kind of, you know, working with them rather than having them work for the United States. So I think that's a pretty, pretty important point.
So in so many ways, this your proposals are both strong and in some ways almost obvious, but in other ways they stand against the very real practices and habits that we built up during the global war on terror, because so much of what was being put forward there in terms of partner relationships and security cooperation relationships was urgent, or at least it was billed as urgent, and often short-term and for near-term goals without thinking through the possible consequences of those partnerships, not only to the security situation itself, but also just to the broader strength of that partnership. Whether are you abusing that partnership by starting it? So I'm wondering, before we go over to Kaylee, who do you think are the potential biggest opponents of shifting to this, whether they realize it or not, and who are the possible greatest allies? And I mean that not necessarily just like in a other country sense. Who are the possible allies to shifting this to this more principled approach, where that and treating partners as partners rather than just as proxy?
Of the people that we had spoken to, and just kind of as we've worked the issue around kind of gray zone hybrid warfare tactics and so forth, actually the military, the U.S. military, especially folks who have been involved in security cooperation, really understand the importance of leveraging and working with allies and partners rather than, you know, using and abusing. I mean, I think there are plenty of examples in the recent past of relationships gone awry and just what the fallout has been from those examples. And so I think that it's been really interesting to see just, you know, how much importance the military, folks in the U.S. military have put on that particular, just emphasizing that point of making sure that we are working with and not we're not using allies and partners. I think that it's also, it's definitely tough because the mechanisms that the United States has in place, the bureaucratic structure that the United States has in place and the security cooperation relationships that the United States has in place are very much, you know, they're kind of built on more conventional terms, and it's going to be really difficult to kind of break that mold. And so therefore, I think it's something that we talk about in the paper also is to focus on, you know, the non-military side of things, you know, empowering where, again, the United States military, that's a great strength that the United States has, but there are a lot of non-military, non-kinetic means that are not being leveraged, you know, everything from, I mean, the poor State Department all the way through public-private partnerships. You know, these are things that we should probably be focusing more on.
So Kaylee, now moving to the most dramatic, most angsty, most friction-laden topic that we're going to go over today. Another U.S. relationship that is billed as being based on principles and values in order to drive a broader security partnership, but has undergone just a tremendous amount of change even in the last few years in terms of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And what I think you wanted to talk about today is sort of where we are in the discussion of a two-state solution, one-state solution in Israel, and how much those parameters have shifted, maybe without the ability to return to where we were, you know, 5 years ago. So, like, there's been a lot going on in Israeli politics in the last even just few weeks. So we're not going to be able to go over all of it. But if you could just kind of give us a sense of what has the sea change been in, and where are we now, right now, in terms of the one state, two state solution concepts overall.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack, and obviously we're only covering a little bit here, but I do think it is important to bring up the fact that there is a renewed debate happening right now about the viability of actually being able to achieve the two-state solution. That debate has happened many times before, obviously at different points where the status quo looked different. You know, this isn't just a new thing that's happening under the Trump administration. Secretary Kerry was warning of the death of the two-state solution, you know, back in 2013 and again in 2016. But obviously a lot of things have changed on the ground and have also changed in the U.S.-Israel relationship. And then also in American domestic politics here at home. I think what's important to note here is, you know, from earlier this year, which I can't believe it was just earlier this year, the release of the Trump peace plan, and then, you know, talks of the potential for annexation or plans for annexation of parts of the West Bank by Netanyahu's government, that those have all kind of drummed up this sense of, you know, the wheels are off the track. Where are we headed? How are we actually going to reach a resolution to this conflict? And what does that resolution look like? The establishment of two states has long been the focus of peace efforts, both, you know, from an Israeli perspective and a Palestinian perspective. They didn't agree about how to get there. That's where we are. Where we are today in a very oversimplified version of those events, but they did agree, you know, the eventual goal here was to achieve two side-by-side independent states. Now, the two-state solution is actually kind of at its lowest point of popular support among Israelis and Palestinians and even, you know, the American Jewish community at home. So it's really been interesting to see kind of as this conflict has gone on for decades upon decades upon decades, thinking about the fact that the Oslo Accords were almost 30 years ago. They actually happened before I was born. So that's just, you know, the fact that I'm, you know, sitting here talking about this conflict and about what's going to happen when we thought we were at kind of our closest point to reaching resolution that long ago. So there really are kind of, to sum up, four problematic trends that don't kind of inhibit only a two-state solution, but also some of the alternatives that you mentioned, such as one-state solution or confederation. These four trends inhibit the realization of all of those solutions because they really do detrimentally affect the people on the ground. And those are, one, of course, as I mentioned before, Israeli territorial expansion. That's both settlement activity and the potential plans for annexation. To Palestinian division and political dysfunction. You know, the Palestinian Authority is not at its strongest point. And people, especially Palestinian youths, are feeling that. They want a job, they want a passport, they want to vote. And so that puts a lot of pressure about, hey, maybe one state is the right way to go. Three, a worsening economic and humanitarian situation in the Palestinian territories, not just in the West Bank, but especially in Gaza, where millions of people suffer, you know, not just high unemployment rates and low GDP per capita, but don't have potable water, don't have electricity, kind of basic human needs are not being met. And then fourth, really a hardening of views on all sides. And that's kind of what we've been seeing play out in the news today is people are really, you know, staking claims and not talking to each other. And so it's really hard to imagine not just, you know, a two-state solution, but any sort of negotiated outcome being achieved in the coming years.
One of the things, well, there's so many things that strike me out of the summary that you just gave, but one being that there have been generations of people who have been working on this issue in the United States, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, and elsewhere. And they have all come into it, as you said, with, you know, lots of differences, but some assumptions that were fairly comparable, at least that they were working towards the same goal, even if it would, they disagreed on the barriers and the means to get there. Do you think that with everything that you just mentioned in terms of like everything that is significantly more difficult now, there's going to be a new generation that comes out of this that is either abundantly more cynical or is going to attempt to generate an entirely new set of ideas that may be not possible, but like that may stand up as a stronger viable alternative? Because right now we've been over the last several decades just kind of debating around really, really difficult margins. Those margins have been impossible to work through, but they have been in effect margins in a lot of cases. Is there necessarily hope, because there's the picture you laid out was fairly negative, but are we at a point now where like the only way out is something very different, or the only way out is a very different set of politics in Israel and Palestinian territories, which may also come with a generational shift?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And you want, in this sort of bleak situation, to look for where those pockets of hope are. I mean, I think both on the Israeli-Palestinian side, there are so many young, energetic people who are putting their energy and their thoughts towards this. So that's hopeful. I always enjoy speaking to my counterparts there. I would just say, I think from an interesting perspective, speaking of the American Jewish community here in the United States, you know, there is a generational, you know, an age differentiation between how people view what kind of, or which solution the United States should support. So, you know, a 42%, a plurality of those aged between 18 and 34. So people who really haven't seen an actual peace effort happen in their lifetime are in support of the U.S., you know, being behind one state equal rights. And then of those aged 35 and above, only 32% are in support of one state, and a plurality of those people actually still support two states. So there is kind of a change in how people are viewing this. I mean, that's important because one state equal rights means giving up the idea of a Jewish state and how it has been imagined for many, many, many years. And that's obviously happening more quickly among a younger demographic. I think the question of when do you keep pushing for two states versus when do you start looking for viable alternatives? Do we need kind of just like a big grand new idea? We've been kind of beating down the same door with few results. I think it all comes back to those four trends, and fighting against those, I think, benefit whatever outcome one person actually believes in. Like, fighting against those is not going to be detrimental to achieving that outcome. And that's what's really important to keep in mind. So whether you support one state, whether you support two states, what your vision is for the future, there are a lot of things that we can all get behind together today and that people see eye to eye on. And so I think there is space to do good work here. And that's what keeps me moving forward.
So ladies, this was an incredible set of discussions that we are going to move on now to our more lighthearted part of the show. I would like to generate a bombshell foreign policy 2020 election bingo card. So what I'm going to ask each of us to do is to come up with at least one, but if not more than that, a couple of terms that you would put on said bingo card. I don't necessarily have hopes that there's going to be a lot of series of debates in the same way there was for the Democratic primary, which, how many debates? There were just a lot of debates. But there will be online commentary. There's going to be Twitter wars. There's going to be town halls. There will be rallies. So I'm curious from everybody's perspective, like, what are those things that you think would go on that bingo card so in order to win? So I will put out mine. So I'm kind of cheating since I started, so I picked the easy ones. Mine are China Cold War and ending endless war. Though I feel those were kind of in the Democratic primary bucket, but I think they'll still keep coming up. Ashley, what are yours?
So going off the China Cold War, great power competition.
Oh, yeah.
So many sentences and hooks now start with an era of great power competition, which I feel like you could say to like how they introduce Law and Order.
Dun dun, in an era of great power competition.
Exactly.
I have written so many sentences about that, and every time I do, it's just like, I want to pull my eyeballs out. This is so bad. Who else has some?
So I'm not a U.S. citizen, but having said that, there are a lot of issues that I personally care about, and so I would hope that immigration and ICE would be two things that would be on that bingo card.
I think that those will definitely be on the bingo card in some form or another. Kaylee?
I'm going to have to go with something Iran related. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to come up, but I think we're going to be, you know, debating again, like the pallets of $1 billion of cash.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't seem to shake it. You know, false fact for those of you who don't know.
False fact.
That'll come up again. Presented as a fact, but it's not, in fact, a fact. And I've now just said the word fact 7 times.
I think you made it a fact in doing so.
I did, yeah. Yep. Oops, my bad. But I think if not that, then at least, you know, who's tough on Iran?
Yeah, toughest on Iran. Kara, what's your addition to the bingo card?
So I think number one, if I'm still allowed to speak, because I believe I already said in an era of great power competition today, as one does. But I'll go with decoupling. Ooh. With China, mm-hmm. Since that is probably going to be used quite often. And the other one is the end of globalization. So as Jonah Goldberg says, the globalists, I think, are going to come under a microscope again with regard to 2020 and foreign policy. So keep your ears open.
Megan.
Probably in the post-COVID era of international relations.
Yeah.
And some probably more so on the Biden side, he'll probably say something like restoring the broken bonds of the transatlantic relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, I think in all likelihood, the Biden team is the only people who are going to use the term transatlantic relationship. So it'd be dicey, but you would know that they would say it a lot for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. These will definitely go on our bingo card. And we will introduce this new concept into the rest of our Bombshell shows for the rest of the year. But to close out our show, we're going to do, as usual, a pop culture discussion. Bombshell just put out 2 weeks ago, I guess, our annual summer reading list. And it is spectacular with all of our many of our prior guests recommending great summer reads and summer fiction. So please take a look at that. What did not make it on the list, because I didn't know it had come out and I'm so excited, is Bill Buford has written a new book about the 4 years that he spent cooking in France, in Lyon, called Dirt, kind of a sequel to his book Heat, which is about his cooking Italian food. One of my favorite books on the planet, and reading Dirt makes me so happy that I only let myself read like a couple of chapters at a time, because it's just like, it's like drinking too much champagne. You just get too happy as a result. So it's so great. So ladies, what else do we have going on in pop culture? What's making you happy or making you entertained these days?
So to kind of piggyback on the French cooking thing, I've been listening to this podcast called Cooking for One. It's by this young American woman who's recently divorced and living out in Paris. And it's both a podcast about French cooking and cooking that she just likes to do when she misses home, but also just what life is like as a single 30-something-year-old in Paris. So I've been really enjoying listening to that podcast. I highly recommend that. And then keeping in the theme of gray zone warfare, you know, some kind of soft power elements there. Turkish dramas have really taken off recently. But one in particular that has been really popular in Pakistan, which is where I'm from, is Dirilish Ertuğrul, which translates to Resurrection Ertuğrul. It's on Netflix. It has subtitles and everything. And in Pakistan, actually, the government is airing it with Urdu dubbing on Pakistani national state TV. So the story is really fascinating. So this makes sense if you've been following Erdogan and kind of his attempt to become this leader in the Muslim world. The story follows the ancestors of the Ottoman Empire. And it's basically this this Turkish tribe that rises up and fights against the Knights Templar in the Crusades. It fights against kind of more, let's say, corrupt elements of Muslim leadership in the Arab world. And kind of, you know, it's this very Game of Thrones-esque, like well-produced, but, you know, with a lot of you know, light propaganda, light morality kind of thrown into it. Very entertaining. My mom and I have been watching it. We binge watched it to the point where we are now, this has come out about 2 months ago in Pakistan on state TV, and we've been watching it with the Urdu dubbing. So we have now caught up to Pakistan, and we're kind of waiting as every day a new episode comes on YouTube.
That sounds amazing. Kaylee, what is on your pop culture horizon right now?
I just started watching the kind of revamped Babysitter's Club
Yay!
TV show on Netflix. I don't know if anyone here read the books,
all
but
of them.
I definitely read all of them. I like definitely wanted to be Dawn, who I don't think I've met yet on the TV show, but who was like very much like a California girl. So like the opposite of me, if you know me. But I've just been enjoying, like, it's total childhood nostalgia, but I'm greatly enjoying the fact that it has like this hard, or not hard, but this feminist bent this time around of, you know, like you start watching, you're already like, oh, they did not just update this to the fact that these girls are like Gen Z and they're like, a landline? What? But also to the fact that, you know, we're living in a world where we're trying to teach, you know, young women different messages and different things about female friendship. So I'm greatly enjoying going down that wormhole, and it's a like point of light and, you know, so much darkness these days.
It also has the Clear phone in it.
Yes, which I wanted
yep.
so badly. Never got a landline in my own room too, which was like a point of great frustration. I was jealous of everyone who had one. I will also note that Alicia Silverstone plays a mom in it.
Wow.
Which also makes me feel old when I watch it. I'm like, oh, and I bet the kids who watch it and who are in middle school don't have any idea who she is. So, nope. Yeah.
Megan, what are you doing for pop culture?
I cannot recommend enough. If you have HBO, you have to watch I May Destroy You.
Okay.
It's by, it's like a dark comedy created by Michaela Cole, who's known for her series Chewing Gum that was on Netflix for a little bit, but they took it down. But it is they call it a consent drama because it deals with sexual assault, but it's based loosely on her own experiences of being assaulted while writing her show Chewing Gum. So it is, she is just from that. She acts in it, she directs, she writes everything. Absolutely fabulous. And check out the, if you're a Vulture fan like me, New York Magazine, you definitely have to check out the amazing profile of her by E. Alex Jung.
Fabulous. Kara, what is keeping you entertained right now?
Okay, I was really hoping that you wouldn't come to me after that because my choices are so decidedly lowbrow and I didn't know that I was so superficial, but I guess I am.
All of mine
are lowbrow. I was going to talk about Kanye West for 2020, like
yeah.
very interested in hearing what he has to say. And then Johnny Depp and Amber Heard's legal battles. Have you guys been looking at this? It's insane. It's a mess. But I think what I'll have to go with now is I've been listening to this podcast called Blocked and Reported, and it's Katie Herzog and Jesse Singel. And it's just kind of a interesting foray into, you know, cancel culture, free speech, and they sort of discuss, you know, some of the topics of our time with sort of an eye towards what's happening in the Twitter sphere, what's going on in the weird, murky internet world. So I find that, you know, somewhat enraging and amusing all at the same time. But for what I'm actually enjoying, to be completely honest, is The Amazing Race. You know, I've never watched it before. Going back kind of in reverse chronological order from the most recent to the older seasons. And it is wholesome. It is charming. It's lovely. So highly recommend. It's a nice respite from everything that's going on in the world right now.
My only reference on the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard situation, which seems very depressing and tragic on many fronts, is just occasionally I'll see these like very sort of Instagrammy photos of what are ostensibly were Johnny Depp's lunch, taken of like, it's like a glass of whiskey, a beer, three lines of Coke, and some other stuff. And like, that just seems, it seems like very well staged. I'm not saying it's actually staged. It just seems it's a very well put together horrible alcoholic drug addicts lunch. So, you know, I guess interesting cultural shift that we're seeing for drug addiction.
Right. And that's not even getting into the severed fingers and the weird nicknames. So.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot going
Gird
on.
Gird your loins. It's interesting.
All right. Ashley, what is keeping you entertained now?
So just a really quick comment. So one of my friends yesterday and I, we were talking about Kanye and his like his presidential election, and then we decided to assign rappers to be different cabinet secretaries. And so one of the things that we came up with, like, you know, MIA should be Department of Transportation, head of the Department of Transportation because of paper planes, mm-hmm. you know, just stuff like that. But then I guess on like pop culture stuff, I've been rewatching Dairy Girls. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely, absolutely amazing. And also been re-binging Veronica Mars. Like, talk about like early 2000s, like super strong, like female characters. And like, they also deal with sexual assault.
A lot.
Yeah, like they did. They dealt with like a lot during that show. So that's kind of what I've been watching. Also been reading a lot. Kaylee recommended this series called The Remnant Chronicles. Super easy, like fast read. Also strong female leads in that as well. So.
All right. Well, ladies, thank you so much for coming to my bombshell takeover. We had a fabulous episode. I feel like this could have, so many of the issues you're working on, we could have talked on for much longer. So thank you for coming on. This was great. We will have this out on Tuesday, which I will mention right now that I think Kara for the CNAS annual conference series is doing a really cool thing on, oh my gosh, Kara, remind me the title of your session on Wednesday. I'm forgetting the title.
Yeah, it's on synthetic media.
Yes.
And it's called Is Seeing Still Believing? So we'll challenge the audience to see if they can detect AI-generated digital forgeries versus actual static images or video or even audio and text. So it's going to be a really interesting challenge. We'll see if the audience, you guys, the general public, is any good at detecting what media is synthetic and what's not. And we'll talk about all the implications for the election, for national security, and on and on. So 2:30 on Wednesday, come and join.
That's going to be fabulous. Thanks so much, ladies. Have a great rest of your weekend.